Hey there. My name's Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table's a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is an edited version of something that we call the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with the hope that it can be a positive catalyst and encouragement to you in your own explorations. In our experience, exploring what we believe can sometimes be hard work, and we don't think anybody should have to do that alone. We're able to offer this because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond a local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com. Thanks for dropping by. Well, welcome to the Talky Bit. Last week we talked about some ideas about religion, and one of them that we touched on that I want to unpack a little bit more was this idea of religion as language. And so that's sort of where I want to start this week. With the idea that any religion is, among other things, a collection of language and symbols that has been gathered together for a particular purpose. And that purpose is to express something that would otherwise be inexpressible, to express something mysterious. I'll unpack this metaphor another time, but I had it on the back end of my notes, and when I was printing them out this morning, I was reminded. So I'm just going to mention this metaphor to you. We'll have some fun with it another time. But listen to this. I can't even source it because where I got it from, the person carried it as sort of oral knowledge, and they couldn't remember the source. But here's the idea. And so this is a reference to the way science creates knowledge. So think about it this way. If you're picturing the growth of knowledge, imagine it as an island, and it's like we're on an island of knowledge. And that island is located in an ocean of mystery. And so when knowledge grows, in that metaphor, we imagine the island growing, because that's the correlation in the metaphor. When an island grows, one of the things that happens is its shoreline grows. So as the island of knowledge grows, so does the shoreline of mystery. And with that in mind, when I think about religion as language and symbol gathered together to try to touch mystery, it seems like it's one of the things that's running around on the island, just a little bit. And so when I think about it that way, I think about religion as ready-made languages that arrive with all the components that are necessary to express the same emotions and desires. So this idea that religion's not just a religion, so I want to always be careful with that idea in our context, that whenever I'm talking about religion, I'm talking about the category, not a particular religion. And similarly with a word like faith, which Christianity has enjoyed so much sway in this part of the world that we've conflated on many occasions the word like faith with particular expression of faith. So we would even use a phrase without considering it, like the faith. Interesting. So whenever I use those words like religion and faith, I'm talking about the categories, not the specifics. So that's the way religion behaves as language. Ready-made languages comes with all these components that are necessary to express emotions and desires, but from religion to religion, with different details and different stories to do that work. And so if we look at the idea of religion as language or story through that lens, thinking of one religion as superior to another is basically akin to thinking of one spoken language or written language as superior to others, simply because we know the language better. You might have, I was thinking about this on the drive here, having had the privilege of some travel in our lives, and perhaps you have as well. I mean, we can have this experience right here on this continent as well, as a multicultural space, but where you're speaking to someone or you hear someone speaking to someone who doesn't speak their language, and the tone of the conversation is that one of those people is being treated like they're inferior because there's a language barrier, and that's the whole story. You're lesser human being because you don't speak my language. That's, as soon as we stand back from it, we recognize it as absurd. How utterly ridiculous. It's not the acknowledgement or fluency of a certain language that's the problem. It's the assumption that that fluency or comfort or adeptness with one language makes it better than another. And it's easy to unconsciously make that kind of an assumption, right? Because of familiarity. And this seems like it would especially be the case once we can acknowledge that all these different languages are capable of speaking about the same things, about feelings and experiences and desires and facts and all the things that matter to us as humans. Basically, if we think about this in terms of the language of religion, all those different religious languages are capable of speaking the language of faith. And at a quick pass, that could sound like all religions are the same, which is, of course, not the case any more than all other kinds of language are the same. But it does point toward another question, which might be stated as, how unique is religion as an ideological category? So if we're going to consider these, if we're going to use the language of religion to embrace several expressions of religion, then how unique is the actual category in our human experience? And that's a hard question to answer, maybe even to consider if you've grown up soaking in religion, as many of us have, being taught often that the particular religion we're soaking in, sometimes from when we were infants, this idea that the system of belief that we're growing up in was, in fact, unique. And not just unique, which just means not like any other, but also superior. But if we stand back from that idea a bit, which is admittedly not an easy thing to do, we might be able to see that religion as an ideological category actually might not be especially unique in human experience. Then what I want to do is offer some possible objections to that line of thinking. I'm not going to explore those in detail. I'm just going to list them, a few of them as representative, and I'll respond to them. So one objection to that idea that religion is not an especially unique ideological category for us as humans is that religion is unique because it deals with absolutes. So does nationalism. Religion is unique because it's all about in-groups and out-groups. So are most groups that have hegemonic beliefs about pretty much anything. Ever try to be a moderate flat earther? Whatever, pick one, right? I thought that one was kind of funny, personally. So the argument is that religion is responsible for the greatest acts of violence in the world. And this is a pretty common one, especially as the curtain gets pulled back on more and more of the messy integration of church and state in sort of what I'll call the Western world. Well, to put that paid, I think, is simply to take a quick pass at history. Arguably, some of the most egregious acts of violence in the history of humanity, at least in terms of scale, have taken place in the last 100-plus years. And they have been motivated, in many instances, by non-religious or irreligious ideologies. Nazism, Maoism, Stalinism, it's not an exhaustive list of isms. Some would particularly want to include aggressive expressions of capitalism in that list. Whatever ideology in that kind of a list of isms we might want to exempt or defend, I think the point remains a reasonable one. Religion isn't especially unique in many of the categories that are often used to suggest that it is. And one of the things that is often misunderstood is the most typical way that religion functions in the context of culture. My grandfather and my mother, following on his example, liked his folksy metaphors, and this is the point about which he would probably have said something like that we have this tendency as human beings to put the cart before the horse. I don't know if you've ever seen up close how a horse is typically hooked to a cart. But all you have to do, you know, we don't have to get into the weeds on that. Just imagine the visual of a horse pushing rather than pulling a wagon. And you're kind of on the right track. And once you know how harness systems actually work, the metaphor just gets richer and sillier. Getting this order backwards would result in a situation, so in terms of this relationship between religion and culture, would result in a situation that's akin to trying to, it's another one of my grandfather's, trying to move a rope by pushing it ahead of you, you know, instead of dragging it behind you. Like, it just doesn't behave very well. It's not very effective. But we do this all the time on one particular matter that has to do with religion. And I should say, in the interest of nuance, that there are exceptions to the point I want to make. Absolutely, aren't there always? So what I'm going to do is kind of give the core idea first, and then we'll touch on the exceptions. So centrally, the idea we often get backwards is this notion that religious people derive their values from their sacred texts. So that's kind of not an unusual understanding of the way religion functions, and it actually works for the vast majority of folks the other way around. What happens is that people in a certain religious expression insert their values into their sacred texts. I think one of the most flummoxing, disconcerting discoveries that many sincere believers make when they start to more seriously study or deconstruct their own religions is just how many different ways there are of understanding what a defined collection of texts have to say and what they might be taken to mean. And this discovery that, you know, text X can be made to mean almost anything, that's startling enough that, at least in my experience, it's caused many a graduate theology student to feel like they no longer have a belief system at all, or at least not one they can trust. When you've been told it has to mean this or it doesn't mean anything long enough, and you discover it could, in fact, legitimately mean many other things, what does that mean about the thing you were taught, right? That's a disconcerting experience. So having said that, you don't have to look very hard to find an institution that will carefully steer you clear of those kind of disconcerting discoveries and still give you plenty of interesting things to think about. But about those exceptions, in many, maybe all, but I can't speak with any lived experience to this, but in many religions, there tends to be a subset of adherents that is committed to what author Madeleine L'Engle liked to call fundaliteralism. She objected to the use of fundamentalism, the way that we often use it in our culture, and her argument was basically that there's nothing wrong with fundamentals. That's not the problem. The problem is how we treat the fundamentals, and it was the literal treatment of them that she was trying to get out with her conflation there with as fundamentalism. Simple version of what she meant and what I mean is that there is always this sort of subset in the religious context that brings a commitment to reading and applying sacred texts in an unapologetically and irrevocably literal way. And so this is how you might arrive, for instance, at the idea that the earth is 6,000 years of age. You just add up the numbers that are in the text. You know, you just kind of treat them like a Westerner. And for those that are working with that mindset, the idea that numbers might represent ideas to the people who wrote them down, ideas like, for example, we're gonna say there were 100,000 people. The point is not that there were 100,000 people. The point is that there were lots of people, or that this was all the people. This was the whole tribe, you know, whatever it is, right? But that way of thinking, that's not an option for folks who are coming at things like sacred texts in a fundaliteral kind of way. And one of the patterns that I've observed over the years is that even within those very concrete sorts of systems of belief, very literal systems of belief, most adherents tend to be curiously selective about which texts they will take literally and which ones they won't. Maybe not so curiously selective, but it's an interesting aspect of this. Just because someone believes that the earth is 6,000 years old based on a few verses in the Bible doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to affirm that slaves should obey their masters because God said so, or even that slavery is okay. But if they're ambiguous on that point, and some are, they might still not affirm genocide based on religious differences, something that the Bible portrays God as calling for on several occasions, and so on. Like I said, selective. Even when we espouse literal meanings of sacred texts as human beings, of any sacred text, so again, this is religion as a category, we don't tend to do that in ways that are uniform. We insert our values into the texts, not the other way around. And that's one of the reasons that beliefs change. If you want a sort of outstanding example from within the last few weeks in the news cycle, just consider the Pope's rescinding of the doctrine of discovery. Editorial moment. That was overdue. but it did happen, right? So it's a curious. I know, yeah, we're still playing games. I'm going to take it as progress and call it not enough and carry on. Here's the thing. As relative to what we're talking about, do we imagine that would have ever happened without the shift in values that is presently taking place in the, you know, so-called Western world? Like, there's just not a chance. Here's a little social equation to keep in mind when considering how those sorts of changes might happen. Like lots of equations, this one has its limits, but it's also interesting. Dogma plus authority equals power. Dogma plus authority equals power. So with an equation like that, one of the things we can see is that authority is likely to try to preserve or defend dogma. At least that's what's going to happen until said authority either has its own internal values shift or perceives that not changing the dogma will begin to result in a loss of power. So you can sort of see how the equation runs in more than one direction, right? And if you think that's too cynical, and I think that's a real danger with an equation like that, I would remind us of what AA calls a fearless and searching moral inventory and suggest that a good place to start for any of us is to do that for us, for ourselves, and ask ourselves about our own inclination to change or not change our own values as long as they are delivering what we want or need in the world. I had a wise mentorish person point out to me one time that that we don't tend to change until the perceived pain of change is less than the perceived pain of staying the same. I didn't like it when he said it, partly because I didn't like the context. He was talking about me. But also, over the years since that conversation, I find this to be undeniably the case. It's a little bit of the, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know? And we don't experience it as broke if it's delivering what we want or perceive that we need. And I mean, that ripples out into the bigger things we make, right? Into the things we might broadly call culture, in which I would include religion. Now, all of this brings us back to what I said I was going to explore in this talky bit, which is the difference between religious identity and beliefs, or we could say between religious identity and faith. Because that was what I said I was headed for. That was just the on-ramp. Not everyone would agree with this, of course, but over the years I've come to be quite thoroughly convinced that religions are, in fact, something we make. They're cultural realities, they're systems, they're structures, they're artifacts. I don't believe that that makes them one bit less interesting, or less important, or less impactful. In fact, I would say that when it comes to interesting, quite the opposite. When I started to think about religions as cultural expressions or artifacts, that was when I was like, hey, how about that? You can stand back and look at these things. You can have them instead of them having you. And that was a huge shift. They are something that we can do that with. We can study them. We can examine them. We can dissect them. We can compare them. And also, since they are something we make, they are something we can and do change. And I think that's important. When I talk in this context, and I say things like, the community is what the community makes, this is one aspect of what I'm trying to get at. So, we've been spending a fair bit of time on the matter of how we think about what religion is. And that's fine, that's important as a base for all of this. Faith, on the other hand, is in so many ways what we were considering last week when we explored this drive that we have as human beings to imagine a being, a force, a presence, a mystery, the shoreline of knowledge, whatever metaphor we want to use, but something that is not like us, something about which we might use language like spirit. What we described last week based on Karen Armstrong's work as this imagining of a higher power, not just existing, but at work in the world. And just to kind of review briefly, what Armstrong is arguing for there is that this is, in fact, the defining trait of what makes us human. That for a long time we thought the thing that separated us from the rest of the living world was that we were tool makers and users, and then we discovered that there were other living beings that made and intelligently used tools, so we had to let that one go. And then we thought, well, maybe it's language that sets us apart, and increasingly we're discovering sophisticated language between other living things, including trees. The person who wrote The Secret Life of Trees, the European scientist who did that, whose name I can't remember at the moment, just released a brand new book on that same topic, which it sounds like it would be equally fascinating. I haven't read it, but you know, so we're just learning that language is not the thing that sets us apart. And Armstrong basically goes on from there to say the thing that actually defines us as humans is that in all the things that live, as far as we know, we are the only things that have this capacity and this drive to imagine something not like us that not only exists but acts in the world that we experience. It's an interesting idea. So building on something like that, that idea that we have this drive, then one expression of that drive, and I think a very significant expression of it, is that we make language, we make symbols, and we make structures in an attempt to articulate the emotion or the transcendence of that thing that we're talking about. And we spent a bunch of time last week talking about what constitutes transcendence and that drive. Faith, we could say, is ineffable. It's mysterious. It's a matter of the heart. It's an emotion. It's a feeling. And religion, so here's the distinguishing definitions as I'm working with them. So if that's what faith is, religion is one significant way, not the only one, but it's one significant way we talk about that. So it's one way that we talk about the thing we might use a word like faith for. It's not the only way we talk about that. So that's something that's often been conflated in the history of religion, right? When a religion has said our definition of that mystery is the only one that's valid, that takes those two definitions and turns them into one thing. And separating them from one another is very important. So what does that mean when it comes to the difference between things like faith, religious values, religious identity? Well, most of us are probably aware that there's this oft-cited decline in religious identity, shows up in widespread polling data. And by religious identity, survey data means those that are willing to name a particular religion in the "what religion are you affiliated with" box on the survey. Right? So that's what that language means at its source. In other words, who's willing to check Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Buddhist, Baha'i, and so on and so forth, right? However long the list is. And then in that data category, there's this category that often gets called the nons. And that is for those who would answer the affiliation question with, by checking the box, none. As in, I'm not affiliated with any particular named religion. So from a statistical point of view, that's the definition of the nons. And on this continent, the current statistical drop in religious affiliation around that equation gets called things like precipitous fairly often. It's going down fast, and it's going down fastest in those that are younger. So that's kind of the general trend. And just to kind of, for those of you that are like, Tim, those are a lot of interesting ideas. How about some data? Let me just soothe you here with some data. So in the U.S., which has a stronger national identity as Christian than Canada does by quite a margin, like by over 20% difference right out of the gate, this category has seen a drop of almost 10% in the last few years to the lowest that it's ever been in the colonial history of that nation. And it's been predicted that if that trend continues, a religion that once claimed the adherence of over 70% of the population, so again, that's the American number, once claimed the adherence of over 70% of that population will have less than 50% by 2050. So not very long. And I would contend, actually, that aside from events that I hope would not happen, I think that drop will be faster. But the one thing that I could easily imagine changing that data trend would actually be, I'm going to be very editorial here, and positional, so have at me later. But I would say the blithe acceptance of what I would call fascism could reverse that in a way that I think would be bleh. Don't want to think about it, but also need to. On this side of the border, in 2021, just over 53% of Canadians identified as Christian. Strikes me as still a remarkably high number, but there's the data. And that was down from 77% in 2001. And the next largest category of identification in that data was the nons, which was at just under 35%, up 16.5% from 2001. So that's interesting. I don't have more current data than that. That's the last broad census data, but it's not that hard to reasonably speculate about where the trend is headed. And from my vantage point, I think we could suggest a relationship between those numbers and that rummage sale idea that I was talking about last week. That this is Phyllis Thickle's idea that about every 500 years or so, and she's referring to the history of Christianity in particular, we have something that she calls a rummage sale, where we take all our values, we get them out there, and we spread them out on the floor and go, yeah, this one still works. We're going to keep that one. What is that? You know, and we go through it and we keep stuff. And the last time it happened was about 500 years ago. We called that the Reformation. And we're having another one, she suggests, at this moment in history. So that's an interesting idea. People are busy sifting through their own religious histories and deciding what to keep and what to discard. Now, part of what I think is super fascinating about this is the corresponding rapid rise of the non category. So just to be clear, though, non in the data doesn't mean atheist. And this gets conflated sometimes, which is why I wanted to pause here. Atheist, by definition, equals materialist. It's the belief that nothing exists that I can't know empirically. The only things that actually exist are the things that I can experience with my senses. There is no shoreline of mystery for a true atheist. It's a very hard position to hold deeply, because you basically have to deny mystery. The number of people, and I'm not denigrating the position. In fact, I have substantial admiration for people who thoughtfully hold it. But the number of people that identify that way hasn't changed very much over the past several years. It sits fairly stable through all those other changes, in Canada at around 8%, and in the U.S. at around 2.5%. So there's not a lot of people who would check that box. But there don't seem to be that many more or that many fewer either over those other changes. But non, which means no religious affiliation, is skyrocketing. So I find it intriguing. It would be very complicated to prove a causal relationship with this, but I find it intriguing that in the same period that those identifying as Christian, in Christians that have countries that have historically maybe identified as Christian, that in the same period those identifying as Christian went down about 24%, those identifying as nons went up about 19%. I don't think it's idle speculation to say the migration is coming from here and going there. And here's the other thing that I find especially interesting. Nons are just as intrigued. So I'm treating a batch of actual humans who are all different, obviously, as a category here because data. Nons are just as intrigued by the realm of the spiritual. So this is not about that. They are, statistically speaking, just as inclined to faith as we've been defining it. They just don't care to be identified with any particular religion. So this is one of the reasons why it's important to separate faith from religion, so we don't get confused. We don't fall prey to the fallacy that to be religious is to have a vibrant faith, or that to have a vibrant faith requires being religious. Right? So it's an important distinction. They're not mutually exclusive, but they're not interlocked. So in other words, this is a group of people, many of whom are looking for language and symbols. They're looking for those tools to talk about mystery, to describe their own spiritual journey, but they're not looking to use the language and symbols in the ways that have been used historically by defined religions, which brings me back to Dallas Green and City in Color's album, and many others as well, but that's a current one that's playing in my head, where those symbols get recast, reconsidered, rearticulated, reused, reapplied, repurposed. When it comes to the ways that this category of people understand the world, they are believers, just not in the way that organization or organized religion has defined believers in the past. And I think that's an important distinction. This is a group of people for whom this understanding is shifting. This is a group that might also be described as people who haven't lost their faith, but they've lost their trust in the religious institutions that have traditionally been the places where we might find a home for faith, the places that have nurtured the language and symbols of faith. It's been their job in the culture to do that. One of the things that the democratization of information and knowledge, and I realize that's one of those things that the internet was celebrated for that has not necessarily delivered on, but hope remains perhaps, and certainly access to knowledge remains. That's certainly part of this, right? That the redistribution, the easy access to things that were once the exclusive province of an elite, not least of all the history of religion, is a really significant contributor to this conversation. For those that wish to dig, we no longer have to get past the same kinds of barriers to know the history of religion we grew up in, perhaps, right? Personally, that idea that this conversation could be summed as being about people who've not lost their faith, but they've lost their trust in religious institutions that have historically been the places where faith was at home and where the language and symbols of faith were nurtured, I find that aspect particularly resonant. And I don't want to paint other people's experience with my brush just because I, you know, have the mic, so to speak, but I'm also aware of many folks whose growing disgust with the behavior of the religious institutions they grew up in is a major reason why they don't want to identify with them. Now, we can get self-righteous too fast as well, right? So we got to be a little bit careful with this, I think. It's easy to condemn at a distance, back to AA, fearless and searching personal moral inventory. Not a bad idea in this regard. These behaviors didn't come from nowhere. But that idea that we're kind of looking at behind the curtain and we're disillusioned. We're like, no, I do not care to identify with that. Thanks very much. Mystery? Yes. Symbols that help me engage with mystery? Yes. Language that helps me wrestle with, express, experience, articulate mystery? Yes. The institutionalization of these things as exclusive or superior? Not so much. Maybe just flat no. When those institutions have claimed to be the incubators and the repositories for someone's faith, but when the curtain gets pulled back on their collective behavior, their revealed behavior makes that characterization harder and harder to believe, that can easily provoke that decoupling, right? That separation, that this does not have to be connected to that. Again, for many, it's not a matter of faith. It's a matter of identity. Many reasons why this distinction is important, but high on the list for me in the context of this community would be the fact that I speak with far too many people who find making the distinction between faith and religious identity tremendously challenging. And I can easily appreciate that. When our experience of faith has often had the context of religious organizations, and those same organizations have provided the language and symbols for those experiences, it can be really difficult to pull them apart. I've long appreciated in my own imagination the metaphor of a tapestry. And I appreciated it before I had a chance to see one of any significance. But having had a chance to see some and to see the backside of some, the metaphor has been a richer and richer one for me. That on the one side, the side we usually see, there's a depending on what the artist set out to do, but there's often a cohesive narrative. There's a story. That all those bazillions of threads have been woven together a particular way to tell a particular story. If we walk around the back, the back is a circus. The back is mayhem. The back is just blah, right? Vomited threads. There's just stuff going everywhere. If we take that tapestry apart, were we able to do so? We would still have all the pieces that that artist used to tell that particular story, wouldn't we? We would have a big pile of thread on the floor. We might not have a story, at least in that moment, but we would have all the components. We would have all the things necessary to make the language of tapestry and tell a different story with it. And for many people, this is the experience that we're having, right? And to take those threads and begin to weave something, and then to encounter the limits to what we can weave by ourselves, and realize that there is an historic and cultural set of reasons why religions have come to be, can help us, I think, both leave religion in certain ways when we need to, with more equanimity, more grace, more kindness, but also to be humble and thoughtful about whatever it is we're making, to not sort of too quickly assume that we will weave something better just because we're weaving something different, or that we can weave it alone successfully any more than the people who wove the last one could. But different, yes. Different, yes. You know? And so I think there's a space in there that where we can be thoughtfully imaginative and very hopeful, because, I mean, among other things, coming to that pile of thread when you're having that deconstruction experience or whatever and kind of going, I start where? You know? Am I going to bother? I think maybe I'll just shovel this whole pile, you know, off to the side and not do that. That's tempting, isn't it, sometimes? Bit overwhelming. So I think to take a thread and go, I'm going to start with this one. What's its relationship to this one? What shall I do now with this, you know? And then to circle back to the exercise that we did together at the beginning of our time this morning, where we were imagining supporting others and others supporting us, to kind of go, well, now, I have this thing that I've woven, and I would like to add to it, but I need to hold it up to do that. I need two hands to weave. Now I need some more hands. You know, and now we're talking about community in that metaphor, right? Now we're talking about going, what does it look like to make something together with other people? You can sort of see how the complexity kind of follows along, right? We may choose to hold both religious identity and the values historically associated with it. We may even feel quite passionate about doing so. What's important to understand is that it's not necessary to do so. It's a choice. We can have vibrant faith. We can believe that there is more to life than meets the eye. We can trust. We can pray. We can love. We can forgive. We can serve. Whatever it is that we find embodies our spirituality. And we can do that with or without identifying with an institution. And this is, among other things, one of the reasons the table exists in the form that it does, unaffiliated with any denominations or other institutions. It's not so we can be rogue in some negative or combative sense of that word. It's to make a home for exploring what we believe in ways that make space for the possibility that we can have faith, even be part of a community filled with people who are spiritually alive, people of faith, and not have to identify with any particular religious institution. It's a space for experimentation, essentially, not for codification. We can explore what we believe, we can explore our faith without the unnecessary encumbrance of being told which language and symbols are the exclusively valid tools for that exploration. But at the same time, we can reference tools that fit our hand, that we're familiar with for some reason, and find them helpful in the process. And sometimes not helpful and needing to be set aside. We can examine religion as critically as we're able without fearing that our faith is at stake. And in the process, we can, if we wish to do so, be part of reimagining of religion, not as a category, but as a particular amalgamation of language and symbols gathered together to help us, not somebody else, at least initially, speak of the experience, our experience of faith, of spirituality. Consider this, to return to that little equation that I mentioned earlier. We don't have to worry, in this context, about preserving dogma because we are not concerned with holding on to power. It's kind of liberating, isn't it? Also precarious in its own way. Absolutely. Right? So we need to not be naive about it, but we can be very joyful at the same time. I think it's important. So, with that in mind, let me just say that in this context, my encouragement would be to keep exploring what we believe and to keep working to make and offer as safe a space as we can where we and others can do the same. That's a pretty good reason to exist as a collective, as a community. I think it's essential. And as one of my thoughtful friends pointed out, bigger is not always better. Having said that, it remains my belief that there are not more people in this room simply because of two reasons. One is that there's a lot of people that don't know it exists. And the other is that when I talk to people about its existence and I try to explain it, I meet with two things fairly typically. Joyful incredulity, something that I've had people, religious, irreligious, across a huge spectrum, kind of look me in the eye and go, that sounds kind of cool, which is a really lovely thing to experience. But also, in that range of experiences, to meet with people whose response is disbelief or suspicion or fear. And those emotions tend to speak to me about someone who has not had occasion or made the choice to do the work of considering the possibility of separating religious identity from faith. Because once we make that maneuver, we've just got a completely different playing field on which to explore what we believe. Going to leave it there for now in terms of this talky bit and say thank you for listening through all the distractions. It's been good to be with you.